On this week's COVID Race and Democracy, we look at the growing pandemic and how it threatens the lives and livelihood of millions of people in the United States and the world.
In 2020, we're still in debt to Wall Street. We don't need to give them one penny, not one penny to Wall Street. If they lay off our people, we should shut it down.
The upcoming COVID relief package from Congress does not include funding for cities and states throughout the country. More than a million public sector employees, including teachers and healthcare workers, are already joining the unemployment rolls.
They will absolutely use this as a springboard to carry out attacks, not only on other elected socialists. They will go after anybody who has the temerity to fight for a progressive agenda.
We'll hear from Seattle's socialist city council member, Kashama Sawant, who represents a grassroots movement for a livable wage, Medicare for all, and housing as a human right. She is now facing a recall campaign financed by big business, among other players.
The most striking feature behind what is now being called the Pfizer vaccine is that it was developed by two immigrants that were forced out of their countries due to the hardship their families faced when they were in Turkey.
And we'll learn about the Pfizer vaccine, whose prototype was developed by the German company BioNTech, started by two Turkish refugees in Germany. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Esther Ivarum. The health, race, and political crises of the United States converged on the weekend of December 12, 2020, when hundreds of maskless Trump supporters descended on the nation's capital in advance of the Electoral College vote on December 14th. This is my report about December 12th, originally produced for On the Ground. Now, instead of this Electoral College vote being a pro forma exercise in a normal American election, the 2020 Electoral College vote was an exercise in an abnormal American election. Keen observers are referring to what is happening in D.C. as a rolling coup attempt by a cohort including Donald Trump, Republicans, and various right-wing extremist organizations who refuse to accept a Biden victory. Many of these forces converged on Washington, D.C. on the weekend of December 11th, 12th, and 13th in advance of the December 14th Electoral College vote. On Saturday morning, the area around Freedom Plaza in Northwest D.C. was the gathering place for several pro-Trump groups, including a Trump parade and a group called the Jericho Movement, which, like in the Bible, spoke of marching seven times around the Supreme Court to make the walls of the court come down. Ali Alexander, described as a founder of the Stop the Steal movement, exhorted the crowd with a mixture of politics, religion, conspiracy theories, and boosterism for emerging far-right news organizations such as OAN, NTD, the anti-China Epoch Times, and Newsmax, which reportedly for 1 hour of the rally beat Fox News in ratings.
So I guess I don't have a speech as much as I have a warning to the establishment. We will shut this country down. We believe in some good trouble, right? Maybe some Make America Great Again trouble, right?
While the actions during the day were about verbal vitriol and threats, by evening, gangs of violent thugs, including some identified as members of the Proud Boys, roamed throughout downtown Washington, D.C., physically attacking several people. Four people were stabbed, four black churches were vandalized, Asbury United Methodist Church, Metropolitan African Methodist Episcopal Church, Mount Vernon Place United Methodist Church, and Luther Place Memorial Church. Black Lives Matter signs were torn down from the churches and burned on the ground, surrounded by what looked like lynch mobs. While D.C.'s Metropolitan Police Department did not contain the various roving gangs that appeared out of alleys and mob-attacked individuals and couples, a thick police presence with barricades and bicycles kept white supremacist groups from converging on Black Lives Matter Plaza near the White House or destroying the art and memorials there, as they did last month. Protection of the plaza was so strict that many Black Lives Matter supporters who tried to enter the plaza to participate in a scheduled community celebration could not enter. This is On the Ground reporter Lydia Curtis.
I felt betrayed by the police, because you would think if they're out to protect the public and I'm clearly, you know, in a danger zone, that they would want to do something about that. But they obviously weren't interested in preventing anything. It was just Confederate flags, Trump flags, people in paramilitary gear that were not police. And then one of the white supremacist protesters had a bullhorn, and he started talking about people being traitors and trying to shout over the police line to the Black Lives Matter protesters and how it was a treasonous act and that we should be hung. And when my husband heard the word hanging, that triggered him. So he started cursing, because that just flashed him back to the lynching day. The atmosphere was very tense, because it was nasty rhetoric coming off of the bullhorn from the Nazi group, and just the sight of the Confederate flags and the paramilitary gear. It just made a very nasty atmosphere. And see, I went down there because I wanted to come and, you know, just affirm my beliefs, my culture. It was supposed to be a festival. And it turned out that we could not do that. We were prevented from doing that, because the whole time we had to defend our space all day long. Instead of music and dancing and affirmations, it was a standoff, a hostile standoff the whole time, because they decided they were going to come up to where they were not permitted to come. They did not have a permit for that. They did not stay on Freedom Plaza, which was about 8 blocks away. They walked over, about 100 of them, to try to start trouble over there.
Police said 39 people were arrested in connection with actions during the protests last weekend. Charges were dropped against Philip Johnson of D.C., who was arrested after he was seen on a viral video defending himself with a knife after being attacked by a gang. D.C. Councilmember Charles Allen, chair of the Council Committee on the Judiciary and Public Safety, questioned in a council meeting the disparate treatment of protesters by MPD, which he said allowed gangs of violent white supremacists to roam the streets of the district, but on the other hand, kettles and frequently pepper sprays Black Lives Matter protesters at point-blank range.
People are asking, including myself, why did police officers kettle peaceful protesters on Swan Street, liberally deploying chemical irritants, but we witnessed militia-like bands of white men damaging historically Black churches in acts meant to incite racial terror? There doesn't seem to be a similar intervention by those nearby officers. I know many residents have reached out to me. Several of you, my colleagues, have reached out to me as well, who are alarmed at the disparity of when and on whom MPD shows restraint and when officers are quick to use force and chemical irritants.
On the actual day of the Electoral College vote, the Michigan State Capitol was shuttered after credible threats of violence. There were similar threats in Wisconsin. Not only was there this threatened violence, the right wing also carried out a strategy of selecting their own slate of electors in Pennsylvania, Georgia, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Nevada. In Arizona, fake electors sent notarized documents with their votes for Trump to the National Archives, as opposed to the actual vote from Arizona, which was for Joe Biden. Now, in this rolling attempted coup, or maybe it's just Trump's prolonged fundraising campaign, the field is constantly being extended. Now the Trumpists are looking at January 6th, when Congress assembles to count the Electoral College votes. Some Republican lawmakers, led by Representative Mo Brooks of Alabama, have said they plan to object to the electoral votes cast for Biden. And if they do object, they would still need both the House and Senate to agree with them. And so it is a long shot that they will be successful. Senate Leader Mitch McConnell advise them not to attempt this strategy. This is Esther Evarim for COVID, Race, and Democracy. And again, that was my report on the political and racial violence in Washington, D.C. on December 12th. One postscript is that Donald Trump is denying a December 19th New York Times report that he's inquiring about the imposition of martial law to overturn his defeat in the presidential election. Now we go to Seattle to hear from Socialist City Council member Kashama Sawant, who represents a grassroots movement that has fought for a livable wage, Medicare for all, and the right to housing, among other issues. Her campaign is now under attack from billionaires like Jeff Bezos, companies such as Amazon, as well as the Democratic and Republican establishment in a recall effort. Councilmember Sawant has been a part of a grassroots campaign to make major corporations pay their fair share of taxes. Pacifica's Elliot Avila brings us this interview with Kashama Sawant.
I'm on the Seattle City Council, serving my seventh year in office. I'm also a member of Socialist Alternative, a nationwide organization of social and economic justice activists. And our council office has shown a fundamentally different approach to politics than what we observe and is what's on offer from the Democratic and Republican establishments, who, despite their clear differences, also have in common that they serve Wall Street interests. Our office, of course, stands as socialists. We stand with working people and the oppressed under capitalism, and we believe in using our office as a platform for building wider social movements. And on that basis of building mass movements, we have won the $15 minimum wage. We made Seattle the first major city to have won that important historic victory, which then went nationwide to many other cities and states. And just recently, during the height of the Black Lives Matter movement, which we were part of, we also succeeded in building a movement to win the Amazon tax, which is a tax on the largest and the most profitable corporations, to fund a major expansion of affordable housing and Green New Deal programs.
Speaking of that tax, you are now the victim of an attempted recall scheme, I understand, by Amazon.
This recall didn't just fall out of the sky. It is a product of political events in Seattle since we got elected. And I think particularly it is important to look at the events of last year when we ran for our second election, re-election or third election. What happened was not only, as you said, Elliot, Amazon and big business and the Chamber of Commerce carried out just an unprecedented spending of money to try and get the socialists out of Seattle City Hall. But it wasn't just big business. It wasn't just the right wing. Of course, both of them were completely against us. But it was also the so-called progressive Democratic establishment. And we have to unabashedly fight for our interests, because if we don't, look at the society we are living in. Right now, virtually every person who is listening to this show has been in crisis for months because of the pandemic and recession, and because so many young people are stuck in low-wage jobs in general. But who's profiteering from the pandemic? It's Amazon. It's other tech corporations. It's the real estate corporations. Just to give you an example, Essex Management, one of the top real estate corporations in the city, in our city, it's a Wall Street company. They are the most evicting corporation they are the ones who evict renters the most. But they're making record profits during the pandemic. So it is by no means this mythology of shared sacrifice that is happening here. And so I think we have to refuse to accept the rule book of the political establishment and take great pride in fighting for those who are marginalized, those who are affected negatively by this crisis and by this system. And also understand that when we do fight for our rights and we do succeed in building movements, and not just that, but those movements win historic victories, then expect a backlash from corporations, from the billionaire class, from the Democratic and Republican political establishments. Expect a backlash and fight against it. You know, defend our movements against these attacks, and then link those defensive struggles to an offensive movement, including demands like COVID relief and a guaranteed Green New Deal jobs program for a socialist Green New Deal to cancel rent and debt and mortgage payments for those who are impacted by COVID, making really raising the demand that big business and Wall Street banks and corporate landlords should pay for this crisis, not ordinary people, renters, small business, struggling small businesses and struggling small landlords. And I think It is important for us to engage in this fight, both defending against these attacks and then really connecting them to winning further victories, because there is not going to be any time in our life and or any situation in this universe under capitalism where we fight for our rights, but it is not going to come with a backlash from big business. And the only way we can fend off these attacks is by building solidarity in the grassroots. And that's why the people who are listening to this, it's very important that they stand with us, because if we let them get away with this recall in Seattle, then they will absolutely use this as a springboard to carry out attacks, not only on other elected socialists. They will go after anybody who has the temerity to fight for a progressive agenda. They will go after leaders of movements like the movement in New York City, which successfully defeated Amazon and Jeff Bezos. They will go after workers who are fighting to unionize their workplace. They will go after the public sector unions that will fight against austerity budgets. So our only option is to fight back, to win against the recall, and send a powerful message to the working class across America that we can fight and we can win. And so right now we have a major rally planned for January 9th. It's a national and international rally, so everybody should join us there. And then if we win, which we absolutely are going to fight to do, and everybody should stand with us and fight alongside us, I think it will really empower social movements in a big way. But I think regardless of the recall, we have to continue. We have to right now. We can't wait for the recall result and, you know, wait for us to win. We have to right now fight to cancel rent and debt, to extend the eviction moratoriums for COVID relief. And all, we're going to be fighting on all those demands. We are right now doing that. And when we come back from the Christmas break, we are going to continue to fight on those. And so right now, Socialist Alternative and my council office, we are, of course, calling for real COVID relief funded by taxing big business. So in Seattle, we are calling for an increase in the Amazon tax that we have already won to fund COVID relief, and specifically to fund a guaranteed jobs program, a guaranteed Green New Deal jobs program that will create incomes, jobs for ordinary people, and also build a housing, you know, have a real focus on community development.
How can people support you, support the resistance against this recall campaign?
Regardless of where you live across America, we need your support. And so we urgently need to meet people to donate to us. The only way we can win, and in order to win, we need funds from working people, from fellow working people, because that is the only way that we can get our message out. And so if you're, you know, if this message resonates with you, and if you feel like you have a stake in helping us defeat this recall, then we need your help in fundraising, in spreading the word. So wherever you are in your own cities and counties, please reach out to us and we will help you do this. But reach out to the media locally so that we can, you know, we can make more people aware of what is happening. And feel free to contact me personally. I'm always happy to hear from people and really help organize everyone.
Thank you very much, Kashama Sawant. Your Twitter handle is at CMKShama. Your campaign is Kashama, K-S-H-A-M-A, solidarity.org.
And that was the voice of producer Elliot Avila in conversation with Seattle Councilmember Kashama Sawant. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Esther Ivarum. Stay with us.
Hello, everyone. Crazy times, huh? On March 11th, the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a global pandemic. And it seems as if the world has come to a screeching halt. And in times like these, it's natural for everyone to be anxious and scared and not really sure of the future. There's a song that got us through one period in time. And I believe that same song can get us through this period. So from my family, the Aeolians, and myself, we just simply want to say, hold on, let's keep each other in prayer. And at the end of this, we can say we use this time to reset, to relax, and to recalibrate and become more connected with community. It's such a beautiful thing. I've seen more of my neighbors in these last few weeks than I've ever seen. So hold on, and we'll get through this together.
While the U.S. Congress almost unanimously voted for $740 billion for the military, including funding 800 U.S. military bases around the world, workers and their families, as well as small businesses in the United States, are facing destitution. Workers who are members of New York Transit Workers Union, TWU 100, with 30,000 members, recently rallied in New York. They have been threatened with layoffs of 9,000 workers.
We'd like to welcome everybody for coming out. My name is John Ferretti. I'm an executive board member in TWU Local 100. But I'm here today speaking for myself. I don't want to get in trouble with the union leadership, who basically took the opportunity for the MTA voting on layoffs, service cuts, and fare hikes to basically go to sleep and not mobilize members to actually have transit workers' voices heard. So we rank and file members, you know, even though, you know, me and Lee are executive board members on TWU Local 100, we're here as rank and filers because we go through your experiences. We live your experiences. We know what it was like during COVID when we were abandoned by MTA New York City Transit, when we were abandoned by our own union leadership who told us we didn't even need masks, that if we were a healthy person, you didn't need masks. They sold the CDC's lies and told us that we would be fine. We'd be safe. And months later, 130 of us are dead. Tens of thousands of us are infected. The subway system is a vector for the disease and always has been. It was open 24 hours a day for most of the time down here, spreading this disease. And now we're ready for a second wave of COVID. And these bastards upstairs, these opportunists, these political grifters, these liars, what are they doing? They told us, oh, we're heroes. Heroes moving heroes. And now what do they say? You're fired. That's what they say. We don't need you anymore. You're expendable. The people who move this entire planet, the people who move this economy, the people who are essential are being told they're expendable. And I don't know about y'all, but I feel pretty damn angry about it, okay? And we're here to demand self-respect. I don't know if you guys have heard, but the MTA has made a tactical retreat. They will not be voting on layoffs today. They will not be voting on service cuts, and they will not be voting on fare increases in New York City Transit. And that is a temporary victory. They are planning on going ahead with those attacks next month, late in January, if they don't get federal stimulus money. And, you know, I know a lot of people here understand the nature of the crisis. If you're a transit worker, you know why we constantly have funding problems. They have funding problems because there is no tax base to support New York City Transit. Our transit system's funded with $53 billion in bond debt to parasites, the J.P. Morgan Chases of the world, the Citibanks of the world, the Jeff Bezos of the world, making 4% interest off my back, off your back, off the riders' backs. 40% of the revenue for New York City Transit comes from fares, subway fares. It's higher than almost any transit system in the world. You wonder why we got a crisis? Because there is no plan for working class and poor people. Just like Hurricane Katrina, just like Hurricane Maria, Hurricane Sandy, there is no plan for us to survive. There is no social spending to meet the needs of the poor and the working class. The ruling class of this country, and in, here in New York, is the center of world capitalism. They made $77.3 billion in 3 months while 130 transit workers were dying, while tens and thousands of us were infected. Hundreds of thousands in New York City alone. They were having a party at our expense. And now, when the money's run dry and they have a crisis, the solution is to make working class and poor people pay again. And we gotta say hell no. Not a dime. Not a dime for Wall Street's crime. Not another penny for their service cuts. Not one red cent for their layoffs. Not one layoff are we gonna accept. And if Tony Utano doesn't know what time it is, we do. It's time to fight. It's time to tax the rich.
Hello, everyone. So good to be here. I'm in retirement now. It just feels wonderful to be protesting at the MTA. And striking a blow for our working people down in the tubes, on the buses, and in the yards. This might as well be called MTA Inc. because it's beholden to the banks of Wall Street. It's close to Wall Street, for God's sakes. You can't figure it out. Okay? The MTA wants to lay us off. 9,300 people, working people, who just want to pay the rent and got families. That's cool with these guys over here. I don't want to jeopardize the demo if I start cursing, but I sure could. 2010, they laid off 4,500 transit workers. I was in the middle of that. I was not laid off. I had seniority already. Started at 86. Boy, could I give that guy, wow. Won't get into it. 4,500 layoffs. Did anything happen in the union? Besides behind closed doors meeting? No. In station department, we passed a resolution to have a protest against the layoffs in AM and the PM tour. Okay, we had protests at the MTA head's house, so we started picketing there every day. And we began down in Brooklyn where they were processing the people that were laid off. And the leadership was there and made nothing of it. And I made a speech, got people mad, they're jumping up and down in their seats, standing up. There was enough energy there to do something about layoffs, but it really didn't happen. So here we are. In 2020, we're still in debt to Wall Street. We don't need to give them one penny, not one penny to Wall Street. If they lay off our people, we should shut it down. Shut it down. They ain't playing games with us. We will tell our people, shut it down. Nothing moves. Above ground or below, we're gonna strike.
The last pandemic registered in the U.S. was HIV/AIDS. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer interviews University of California, San Francisco epidemiologist Dr. George Rutherford, who worked to develop treatment options for HIV/AIDS and is now working to fight the COVID-19 pandemic.
First, Dr. Rutherford, how did HIV arrive?
It burst on the scene in the same way, very rapidly, in 1981. So, you know, and then you're dealing with issues of trying to teach people, trying to talk to people about how to prevent it when you don't have a complete knowledge base. We talk to people about treatment when there really is no treatment, the need for diagnosis before we really had diagnostic tests. What's different with COVID is that the diagnostic tests were developed very rapidly. I don't know if you remember this, but the test for HIV was licensed on Valentine's Day, 1985. So it took 4 to 5 years to get it. So, I mean, we were right out of the box with a good diagnostic test for COVID. And that, part of that's just the growth of molecular biology. And this is all the payoffs of molecular biology over the years. So those are the big things. And then you end up with people who've been infected and there's stigma. And there's a lot of this can never happen to me sort of feeling that floats around both COVID and HIV. And unfortunately, we're still living with HIV today. Hopefully we won't be living with COVID for that much longer.
The issue of testing and tracing, that was something that was used in San Francisco to fight HIV. How has that worked out today fighting COVID? Because I know that there was an effort initially to make sure that there was testing and tracing of people who got the infection, the virus, and apparently it's not working anymore because of the vast expansion of this virus.
Oh, it actually works. It works pretty well. It's a person power thing. And, you know, we've been keeping up with it pretty well in San Francisco. We've now introduced some of the state's new software so they can actually do electronic notifications, kind of having a technological solution on the end of it. The other thing is that people are in contact with a finite number of people because the incubation period is so short. We're only talking a period of, you know, 3 to 5 to 7 or 8 days, you know, depending on kind of when you show up relative to your symptom onset. With HIV, it's everyone you ever had sex with in your entire life. That was the original contact tracing formula for HIV. In San Francisco, we didn't put a lot of stock in contact tracing for HIV, at least initially, because it's so, you know, there were no kind of temporal limits around it. It's from puberty on. And so you can imagine, and you know, finding people is just impossible. Now, interestingly, in San Francisco, and we're actually involved with this in Africa as well, which is trying to use newer technology for HIV that differentiates old from new infection. So we're saying, okay, we know you've been infected in the last 6 months. Okay, so who are all your sexual partners in the last 6 months? And we'll get in touch with them. So that's a different, that's kind of a different, that narrows this window down and makes it much more practical. Plus, we have something to offer them if they turned out to be infected. In the past, it was just, you know, tea and sympathy. I mean, in the early 80s, there really wasn't much you could do. Now we have, you know, early therapy with antiretrovirals, which make a huge, big difference. And it's really changed the paradigm of HIV control.
This vaccine that's been developed came in a very historic quick time. There is a concern and issue. Is it a vaccine? In other words, I understand that people can still get affected, but they won't get seriously sick or ill by it. And they may also infect other people. Do you think that this is a real vaccine that is actually stopping people from getting infected, number one? And number two, do you think people, even if they have the vaccine, will continue to have to wear masks and other PPE, other protective equipment?
Sure. So legitimate question. So first of all, the trials didn't look, it's not that we know that it doesn't work. It's that nobody looked to see if it affected the carriage of the virus. So those are studies that are now being put together to follow people who've been vaccinated prospectively and to understand if they can actually carry the virus after they've been vaccinated. I think smart money says it's unlikely, but it could happen and we need to know the answer. So I think that what we'll see here in the next few months is whether there's a drop off in, as we start getting more and more people vaccinated, whether there's a drop off in cases, which would suggest that it cuts down on transmission. Yes, people should continue to wear masks even after they've been vaccinated. There's going to be a certain failure rate, as there is with any vaccine, of maybe 5%, maybe a little bit more. And you don't know which of the 5% you're in. So,
what does it mean for the future of the United States and the lessons of this pandemic, which we haven't had one in 100 years like this?
I think the primary lesson is to avoid hubris. You know, it's like we're learning the great lessons of Greek tragedy all over again. You know, we knew about this in the 5th century BC and we seem to have forgotten it. Hubris is a huge problem, right? Hubris led us to CDC saying, oh, we can make enough diagnostic tests for everybody else. We don't need to buy anybody else's. And it turns out to be complete, you know, that was a month down the tubes. Hubris led us to forget the lessons of China. You know, China gave us a 2-month head start on getting ourselves ready and we failed to do it, right? You know, we knew about this on December 31st, and it was, you know, we're still screwing around with it in March. Hubris has led us down the path of screwing around with masks, you know, which is completely unnecessary. There's no point in doing that. It's led us into the, which I think we're probably okay in, although it could have gone wrong, of only backing 4 vaccines, while there are 11 being that have been made around the world, you know, saying, you know, it's only ours that count. I mean, I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned. But I think the primary lesson that I take away is about being cheap, not being prepared. The White House closed its Office of Pandemic Preparedness in this administration. It also defunded the United States Agency for International Development, which had an early warning network for these kinds of viruses, including one that was based in Wuhan, China, that concentrated on bat viruses, that was defunded in October of 2019. Talk about the world's, you know, lamest move. That more than, I think that CDC's initial fumbling of the reagents for the tests, I think those are, you know, really unforgivable kinds of things that we absolutely can't have happen again.
This is Steve Zeltzer with WorkWeek. I spoke this week with Dr. George Rutherford, who is a leading world epidemiologist at UCSF and head of the Division of Preventive Medicine and Public Health. He is also a member of the AIDS Research Institute's Executive Committee.
Now we learn about the Pfizer vaccine, whose prototype was developed by the German company BioNTech, started by 2 Turkish refugees in Germany. Pacifica's Mehmet Beyran brings us this story.
It is a relief to hear that the long-awaited Corona 19 vaccine is finally here and the vaccination of the people at risk has begun. However, the most striking feature behind what is now being called the Pfizer vaccine is that it was developed by two immigrants that were forced out of their countries due to the hardship their families faced when they were in Turkey. It was embarrassing to hear the Vice President Mike Pence blatantly lie that the vaccine had been developed with the help of the US government. Pfizer of Germany, partnering with BioNTech, owned by the Turkish immigrants, developed the vaccine with the $445 million given by the German government. Pfizer, on the other hand, did offer to provide the vaccine to the US while it was still in the development phase. However, like other failures, the US government passed this opportunity. While other countries were signing deals and moving up the line, Trump was giving speeches on America first. The European Union, in the meantime, signed a deal to secure 200 million doses. Pfizer officials have repeatedly warned the US that the demand may put US at the back of the line, but these fell on deaf ears and the urging to pre-order more doses did not materialize. When country after country, state after state, shuts down its public health offices and public health research laboratories that track, research, and develop vaccines and other cures for diseases, this opens the door to corruption, exorbitant prices, and inefficiency. Now we have private corporations, each keeping their research of the vaccine secret, most probably duplicating efforts of other researchers. Leaving vaccines in the hand of corporations and to the market jeopardizes human lives. Private enterprises produce only for profit and are inefficient. Private corporations can manipulate the markets to maximize profits and milk public money while keeping medicine as a weapon to profit more. If it was left to public organizations, the vaccines most probably would have been developed earlier. To shift the responsibility of public health to private corporations, Trump administration cut the budget of National Institutes of Health 18%, which included the budget for the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases by $838 million in 2017. The Center for Disease Control lost 17% of its budget. White House National Security Council, Directorate for Global Health Security and Biodefense, was completely shut down by Trump because it was seen as unnecessary. Economic reasons caused Özlem Türeci and Uğur Şahin's parents to move to Germany from Turkey. They are the two immigrants who discovered what we now call the Pfizer vaccine. Uğur Şahin is the son of a worker in Germany. His family ended up there because at the time of a post-war boom, Germany needed cheap workers from abroad after it lost half of their exploitable workers when the country was divided. The family was of the Alevi sect of Muslims from southeast of Turkey. Alevis have always been discriminated in Sunni-dominated Turkey, and attacks, mass murder, and lynching has been used to subdue and exterminate them. Uğur was only 4 years old when he moved to Germany with his family. The family experienced racism, xenophobia, and discrimination in return for some economic stability. Uğur Şahin's dream was to become a doctor, and the family gave everything in their power to provide the education to their son. When the news that two Turkish immigrants discovered the vaccine, the lead economist of the Center for European Reform, Christian Odendahl, said, "Germany has struggled with how open it must be with immigration. The program to allow immigrant workers to enter Germany has always been an argument. However, now we see the benefit of foreign workers in Germany because the son of a Ford factory worker may save us from COVID-19. Uğur's wife Özlem Türeci is also from Turkey. Her parents moved to Germany in 1967. Her father was a doctor and worked at a Catholic hospital. Özlem grew up in that environment and adored the work the Catholic nuns were doing. She, like her husband Uğur, teaches in universities and is an expert on immunology. After working together, the couple married in 2002. Their focus at work was based on fighting cancer. Their success brought attention to their work, and the company was bought by a Japanese firm, Astellas. This sale for 1.3 billion euros was the highest sale in the field of medicine in German history. The sale also brought considerable wealth to the immigrants, who used the money to start a new research center in medicine, BioNTech. In their new firm, Özlem became the chief medical researcher. She also became the lead researcher when they decided to extend their work towards the COVID-19 virus. While Turkish researchers were developing vaccines with government money in Germany, in their native country, the government, just like Trump, had closed down the public center for disease control where Turkey used to develop vaccines. And it was Turkey that sent its medicine to China only 60 years ago when Asian country was hit with cholera. But that center too has been closed because it was seen as unnecessary. And Turkey is now waiting in line, as does the US, begging to receive vaccines. Turkey will now be getting its vaccines from China. Although the current prices for vaccines fluctuate between $5 and $20, the Turkish government will be paying $75 for each vaccine. The families of the health ministry's high officials and the religious sect that was given the task to administer the vaccines will get their huge illegal cuts, of course. This is how the healthcare capitalists make their buck from human lives. The success of the Turkish immigrants has started a new discussion in Germany on the contribution of foreign workers to the success of Germany. Yet the failure of Turkish healthcare system, the corruption, the indifference to human lives may be the reason why these two immigrants are not even taking the repeated calls of Turkish President Erdogan, who is frantically trying to call them so he too can share a bit of their success. This is Mehmet Bayram reporting for Pacifica.
Internet linguist Gretchen McCullough, with more than 37,000 Twitter followers, rewrote the lyrics to Dolly Parton's signature song, Jolene. This was then performed by Professor Ryan Cordell of Northeastern University. Renamed Vaccine, the song has drawn tens of thousands of views.
Vaccine, 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 vaccine. Begging of you, please go in my arms. Vaccine, 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 vaccine. Please just keep us safe from COVID harm. This virus is beyond compare. The spiky bursts of auburn hair, that COVID, that corona emerald green. Lockdowns took up all the spring, your bubbles soft like summer rain. The whole world waits alone for you, vaccine. We talk about you in our Zooms. We're desperate to enter rooms, but safely, and we've taken you, vaccine. And I can easily understand COVID could easily take my grand, but you don't know what she means to me. Vaccine, vaccine, I'm begging of you, please go in my arms. Vaccine, 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 vaccine. Please just keep us safe from COVID on. One day we'll get on a plane, we'll gather in large groups again. We'll hug people once we get you. Talk with you, my happiness depends on you and whatever you decide to do. Vaccine, 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 vaccine. I'm begging of you, please go in my arms. Vaccine, 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 vaccine. Please just keep us safe.
Vaccine, Vaccine, a parody of Dolly Parton's Jolene, performed by Northeastern University's Professor Ryan Cordell, written by internet linguist Gretchen McCullough. This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Esther Ivarum. Transportation of the vaccines is being done by Teamsters who work for UPS. Richard Hooker is president of Philadelphia IBT Local 623, and he talked with Pacifica about the need to protect all workers, including healthcare and transportation workers.
Our role as UPS Teamsters, what happened is the vaccine comes to our facility. Our members unload it, whether it be by truck or aircraft can, and they put it on the trucks. And our drivers, they deliver it to the hospitals. And it's just a great time right now to be a Teamster. I don't mean to pat myself on the back or anybody else, but when America needed saving again, they went to the Teamsters. So it's good to be a Teamster.
And the issue of your membership, transportation workers, as far as healthcare, as far as your members being in danger of being infected with COVID, what are your concerns about that? And for all workers who are involved in transportation and frontline workers?
Well, just in general, we got to make sure that our workers are protected, proper PPE, proper clean facilities, because it makes no sense to have our workers go out and put their life on the line, their family's life on the line, and then we not take care of our workers. And now, more than ever, you see now we're delivering the vaccine. And if the people who are responsible for getting this vaccine to our nurses and healthcare professionals, if they're not protected, then what message are we sending? Are we saying that these workers, these individuals, their families, are they disposable? Just because we want to be seen as the heroes and in the media, and look at UPS and look at what these guys are doing. What about the working man? What about the working woman? What about his family? We need to make sure that we take care of them. It would be good if we would get some type of hazard pay. We've been doing this since March. Long hours, not seeing your family. And we're exposed to this more than anybody, because we out there going house to house. We're working in warehouses where there's a lot of workers. Even right now in our local, we have 121 cases of the coronavirus. And, it's business as usual. One of my members told me since it's Christmas time, they have, put the needs of the company over the needs of the members. We understand it's Christmas. We understand that this vaccine has to go out. And we want to make sure that, our families can enjoy Christmas, and we want to make sure our healthcare workers and families who have suffered or is suffering from the COVID-19, we want to make sure they're protected, but make sure we take care of the people who are doing the work. Not the CEOs, not the billionaires, but everyday working men and women. We got to take care of them.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Work Week, and I hope that your members are protected and their families, and that we have a protection for all people, all working people in this country who desperately need it.
I agree with that. I agree with that wholeheartedly.
We just heard from Richard Hooker, president of Philadelphia IBT Local 623.
And when we butchered your sons, boy, when we butchered your sons, have a stick of our gum, boys. Have a stick of our bubble gum. We own half the world, oh say can you see? And the name for our profits is democracy. So like it or not, you will have to be free. 'Cause we're the cops of the world, boys. We're the cops of the world.
Opponents of U.S. wars are expressing alarm at reports that President-elect Biden is considering former U.N. Ambassador Samantha Power to head the U.S. Agency for International Development, commonly known as USAID. Pacifica's Ann Garrison reports.
On its homepage, USAID states that its work, quote, advances U.S. national security and economic prosperity, demonstrates Americans' generosity, and promotes a path to recipient self-reliance and resilience. News that President-elect Joe Biden may appoint Samantha Power to head USAID has alarmed opponents of U.S. wars because of her major role in U.S. decisions to bomb Libya and Syria and to assist Saudi Arabia in its aerial bombing war in Yemen. She has also lobbied heavily, though less successfully, for military, quote, interventions, unquote, in African nations, including Sudan, Central African Republic, and Burundi. From January 2009 to June 2013, Power served as Special Assistant to President Obama on the National Security Council. She moved on to become his U.S. Ambassador to the UN. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her book, A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide, in which she argues that the U.S. is morally obliged to stop genocide all over the world. In Watchers of the Sky, a film version of the book, she identifies as a disciple of Raphael Lemkin, the Polish-Jewish author of the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide.
Genocide. So he has a word. Now what?
How did one little guy go about trying to reform the world?
Lemkin turned himself into a one-man lobbying machine.
The convention is adopted by unanimous vote.
Let's open up the world and let light and knowledge come in.
Today is a milestone.
No criminal court has filed genocide charges against the president of Sudan.
This monstrous conflict has to come to an end.
A massive survivor of genocide.
These people are waiting for our protection. We don't need to wait until he finishes his work.
That was Lemkin's point, that perpetrators will be watched, that they will be accountable.
I think at the same time, we have to stop and say, we stop here.
Law is a difference between life or death. I cannot fail. We cannot fail.
I always think about the privilege, you know, of getting to try, just to try.
Here's University of Pittsburgh human rights law professor Dan Kovalik, author of No More War: How the West Violates International Law by Using, quote, humanitarian, unquote, intervention to advance economic and strategic interests. He spoke to RT after the news that Biden is considering Power to head USAID.
Samantha Power represents everything wrong about U.S. foreign policy, particularly U.S. foreign policy under Democratic leadership. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her book, A Problem from Hell, a book that decries genocide. But the interesting thing about the book is that it assumes the West, including the U.S., does not commit genocide. Everyone else does. And that the West has to intervene in other countries to prevent genocide.
The late Edward S. Herman, co-author of Manufacturing Consent and the Politics of Genocide, published an essay titled The Cruise Missile Left: Samantha Power and the Genocide Gambits, in Z Magazine. Samantha Power, he wrote, is loved by the New York Times and won a Pulitzer Prize for her masterpiece of evasion and apologetics for our genocides and call for a more aggressive pursuit of theirs. For Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
This concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We'd like to thank all Pacifica stations and radio affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's edition was produced by Steve Zeltzer and Polina Vasiliev, who along with Akua Holt are the executive producers of the show. Verna Avery Brown is our executive consultant. I've been your host, Esther Averam. Thank you for listening. You can find this and all other episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.